Hello and welcome to Mission Artist. We are hearing today from educator activist Suzanne Lee. Suzanne worked in the Boston Public Schools for 35 years, first as a teacher and later as a principal of the Baldwin School in Brighton and the Josiah Quincy Elementary School in Chinatown. Under her leadership, Baldwin became a nationwide model for school improvement, and Quincy was named one of the best 100 elementary schools in Massachusetts during her tenure. As long as I've known Suzanne, she's been a dedicated community advocate and leader. She helped organize immigrant mothers to launch the first Chinese Parents Association, helped to establish bilingual training programs for workers, and worked with the Boston Foundation to address persistent poverty in the city. She was a lead founder and longtime chair of the Chinese Progressive Association in Boston, a founding member of the Massachusetts Asian American Educators Association, and a member of the Massachusetts Advisory Council on Bilingual Education and the English Language Learners Task Force for the Boston Public Schools. When I first spoke with Suzanne about having her be a guest on the podcast, she didn't see herself as an artist, but I pointed out Mission Artist is about people who use their experiences and their skills to help improve the health and well-being of others. The key element in this mission lies in creative problem-solving and empathy, and Suzanne's resume and history is a wonderful example of this. To begin, Suzanne's family has been in the United States since 1887, when her grandfather first immigrated. Her father arrived in 1938, but due to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which essentially prevented workers from having their families with them, Suzanne had been left behind in China at the age of 6 with her grandmother when her mother and older brother eventually joined her father in the United States. When she was finally able to join the rest of her family, she was 11 years old, and she would be meeting her father and a new baby sister for the first time.
You were, at that point in China, you were living with your grandmother. And she had pretty much been your only family that you had known up until that point. When you learned that you would be going to the United States to join the rest of your family, you must have had mixed feelings about that.
Yes. My mother left when I was 6. So she applied for my grandmother, her mother, to come from China to Hong Kong to take care of me and place me in a really good school in Hong Kong. Her thinking was, if for some chance they couldn't fix the legal problem and get me legal papers to come to join the family, then when I grew up, I could go to the U.S. as a foreign student. So I always knew why I'm in Hong Kong with my grandmother, but I did not know the reason behind it. So when news came, and I was 11, finished fifth grade, it was the beginning of sixth grade in Hong Kong. News came that I was to come join my family. I was so excited. Not that I know where it is. I'm corresponding with my father and my mother all this time, but I've never met my father. So while excited, I also was nervous, let alone going on a plane by myself. And my grandmother and next door neighbors all came to the airport with me, and they put a sign on my lapel, on my jacket, and says Boston, Massachusetts, and put me on the plane. There I go. Didn't speak any English. I remember the plane was Pan Am in those days. Went from Hong Kong to San Francisco. On the plane, there were Chinese-speaking folks. But when we got to San Francisco, one of the flight attendants took me to a room and told me to wait there. That wait was 4 hours, and I have no clue what I'm waiting for. And I did not know that I'm not in Boston yet. I just didn't know where I was. So I was in this room for about 4 hours. Finally, somebody came and got me and put me on another plane. And this time, there was no one on the plane that spoke Chinese. Everyone was English speaking. So by that time, I was so exhausted. And they finally figured out that I didn't speak English. So they handed me a menu and have me point what I wanted. And all I wanted was a cup of tea. So I pointed at tea. And the tea they bought me was not teas that I ever tasted in Hong Kong. It was, I guess, tea bag teas. That's not the kind of tea I drank in Hong Kong. So through that whole long journey, more than 24 hours, finally, when I was woken up right before we landed, I must have fallen asleep through that whole long journey. And when I got off the plane, there was a man standing by the door, the entrance or building in the airport. And it was my father, since I only know him through picture, right? So it was kind of like a awkward situation. So my first introduction to reuniting with my family was a long journey, but it was both exciting and nervous for me. And I remember that first day when I got to our home, not near Chinatown in Boston, but further out. And early in the morning, I woke up and I was the only one awake in the whole house. My brother, my little sister, my mother, and my father. Nobody was awake. I think I waited like 3 hours. It wasn't much later that I figured out, a few days, I figured out, oh, everybody gets up late here. Not at the crack of dawn. Like, but anyway, so yeah, I was nervous and excited.
You put it that you were exhausted, but I have to imagine, I don't know if I could have survived an experience like that.
You know, that experience, I haven't thought about it a lot, and I didn't think about it a lot after that. But that whole experience of having left behind, having grown up with my grandmother, who came out from China to Hong Kong to take care of me, she didn't know Hong Kong at all. So she never let me do anything. So I was pretty much on my own most of the time, navigating. So I guess I kind of developed this tough sense of, well, nobody's around here to cure me, so I do it myself. Yeah, I was 11, and through that whole time, that 6 years, have taught me a lot, how to be independent, how to figure out situation, what to do around me, and don't let anything stop me. So I think I developed that sense of independence and toughness early on. You know, I met so many children through my life, through education, that children have steady resiliency in them. And all they need is a little bit of hope.
You are living proof of that. So, I mean, that's incredible. What was it like meeting your sister for the first time?
Like I said, I was both excited and nervous, and that nerve have not only that I have never met my father, didn't know how to act around him, but also have a little sister who was 4 years old that was born here, and I was excited to have a little sister. You know, my brother is 12 years older than me because of that separation between my mother and my father all those years. So I don't really have anybody to connect to, so I was excited. But as I observe that everybody so catered to my little sister because she is the youngest one. And she's the only one that my father have a chance to be with from being a baby all the way growing up. Because he left when my father was one and he never even saw me. So my little sister was the only one. So he doted on her. And for a while, I couldn't stand it. I said, why is everybody doting on this kids? She should be able to do things for herself. Well, she wasn't. So different from me. So there were a lot of unease, a bit of jealousy, but then I have to take care of her because my mother had to make ends meet. My mother brought home sewing pieces of garment, and that's what she did at home in the sewing machine. And then every day, every morning, she would go pick it up. After she finished, she would bring those garments back to the garment shop. So because my little sister is home, so she had to work at home. Once I got here and she entered kindergarten, my mother went to the factory to work. I end up having to take care of my little sister. So she became my responsibility. So there was an added level of, I would think, yeah, as a teenager, that was resentment. So I didn't have, yes, I did not have a fun childhood or because first was being independent and then lots of responsibility.
In one of the interviews that you did, you had mentioned that you didn't realize that your situation wasn't unique, that you came to learn later on that you were not the only one that was dealing with sort of the same transition. Where was that point that you learned you weren't the only one? There were a lot of people your age having that experience.
I haven't gone to school here starting 11 years old. I knew a lot about life in Hong Kong and life in China when I left when I was two. And all that time I was in Hong Kong. And I had a really great education in Hong Kong. My foundation was solid. But when my father took me to enroll in school here in Boston, the principal just took one look at me and said, oh, I can't put her in sixth grade. She doesn't know anything. So they put me back in fourth grade and was accepted. And there was no one in the whole school that spoke Chinese. So for grades 4, 5, and 6, I was pretty much in the dark, so to say, because didn't know what's going on, couldn't understand the language. There was another family across the street from where we live, but their kids are older, and I would play with them sometime. But pretty much my education from that point on until I enter high school, and I got into a really good high school. My education was interrupted in those 3 years. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get that much about American history. What I learned in high school about American history does nothing resemble what I've gone through. And in fact, I remember one time when I think it was in 10th grade, we're talking about world history and the topic of China was in there. So everybody looked at me. And the teacher said, well, tell us. I said, well, tell you what? I don't know anything about you guys. Didn't teach me anything about this. I was ashamed. I didn't know. We didn't talk about it at home either. Even all that time, I never knew why I was left behind, the real reason. And so I was always ashamed of myself because I'm 2 years, at least 2 years or something, 3 years older than my classmates because I was put back in fourth grade. So I didn't have a lot of friends. Until I enter college. That's where everything opened up for me. My freshman year in college, someone recruited me whether or not I would help teach English to garment workers in Chinatown because I spoke Chinese. I said, well, let me try it and see if I can be helpful. Well, that first semester was the beginning of my teaching career. And I continued to teach those adult ESL classes to garment workers for 10 years after that point. Through those English classes, talking with these garment workers, I learned that pretty every much everybody in my class background was similar to my mother's. And listening to their family story, I said, wait, your whole family didn't come together? You have somebody left behind? Or they were separated from their husband for 15, 20 years? And so, oh yeah, so everybody have similar stories. I said, well, how can that be? So I started discussing this with other students and we self-taught and learned about Chinese American history. That's when I discovered all that about my background. It is not unusual. Everybody in that generation suffered the same thing. Families were divided, separated for 3 generations because of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. When a law was passed to limit or to restrict the immigration of a ethnic group, business folks can immigrate and graduate students, but that's a few far in between. Merchants can bring their family, but not laborer. That means that all the men are here to work. And that means that they don't want you to have a family. That means that people have to go back and forth. So you develop this, what they call a bachelor society. But thinking about my grandfather, then my father and his older brother all went through life here as a single person, but they had a family. So they suffer not having a family around them. And meanwhile, all the women are left behind at the village in China. They don't have a family either, but they are there taking care of the children. So you have this separation that have huge impact on the development of the Chinese American community here. And that's why we have Chinatown, where all the men can call that home because they don't have a home here. And it shaped how Chinese Americans, despite having been here for 4 generations, are still considered as foreigners and as immigrants, and they didn't participate in voting because they were not allowed to. So it shaped our community. And that history got me so angry when I learned about it. I said, how is it that they can pass a law like that? And as I learned about the civil rights movement, and as well as participated in some of the anti-war, anti-Vietnam War activities back in the day when I was in high school and early day of my college years, putting all those things together, I learned such a profound lessons that there are laws that pass in the United States, in America, that are made by people that had never involved the people this law were impacted on. That is not right. What happened when we learned this in American history? The United States was formed by the people, for the people. And what happened to that? But I also learned that things can change if you organize. Learned that from the civil rights movement. Bad laws can change if you organize, enough people understand it and push it to change it. And that's what I learned, for the people, by the people, what that means, that we as citizens can and should have a voice in that.
An article about Suzanne and her role in the 1970s desegregation busing crisis appeared in the Boston Globe last year, and this reminded me of how Suzanne's life as a teacher became bound to the sense of democracy and to the community. She shares how this journey began.
So when I was teaching those adult ESL classes, I came to love my students and learn so much from them, and they're just like my mother. And because we were using the old Quincy School on Saturday for those classes, so other people saw me. So when I graduated from Brandeis, they said, we need bilingual teachers in the Boston Public School, because we have, in Massachusetts, they just passed the bilingual education law in 1972. And I graduated in 74, and they were still recruiting bilingual teachers as the population expanded. I said, well, you know, I'm not an education major, but we saw how you teach and how your connection to students, you can do this. And we really need bilingual people. So I said, well, let me try it. So this is the second time I said, let me try it. End up doing it for 35 years, right? So how funny how things happen. Well, I was recruited to teach fourth and fifth grade with newcomers from the neighborhood. And that started my journey as a public school teacher. I went back, since I was not an education major, even now it's true that you can enter education if you have a bachelor's degree and continue your learning, eventually getting a master, but you have 3 years time to get your teaching license. So I did that as I was teaching. But what I didn't know was that court order busing was about to start in Boston. As a new teacher, my first year, I was so concentrated in my classroom. I didn't know what was going on until the end of that school year. A couple of parents came to me with a letter. They said, Ms. Lee, what does this say? I said, and my heart popped. It says that your children are not coming back to the school next year in the neighborhood, and they are going to be bused to school outside of the neighborhood. But they didn't say where. They said, well, how can this be? All of us live here. This is the school we know. Where are you going to be? I said, I don't know. I'm a first year teacher. I don't have any assignment. So that gut punch feeling in my body said, uh-oh, I might not have a job. And where are these children going? So I asked them, how many people got this letter? Said, we don't know, but we will ask around. Would you help us? I said, well, bring everybody around. Let me read your letters and try to help you figure it out. So that was towards the end of June. By mid-July, we had meetings upward of 100 parents. And obviously, there's more parents than kids from my class. So through word of mouth, they all came. And they decided that they need to voice their opinion and how can they do that. And they want some answers. So I helped them write a letter with 9 issues, send it to the school committee. No response from the school committee. And that letter, those 9 demands, we call them demands, it's really race concerns. It's about safety of children on the bus. So they need a bus monitor. Have someone in the school that they're going to that can speak their native language. So if anything happened, someone can call the parents in language that they understand. Some really basic safety measure that was not done. So when they didn't hear anything from the school committee, we applied to go in front of the school committee, and that took about 3-4 weeks. And by the time we got there, it was already the first week of August. And I remember going there, escorting 3 four members of the Chinese Parents Association that I helped them form that summer to represent their voice. And we waited 4 hours, 3-4 hours in this cramped little room, the school committee headquarters next to the state house in those days. And when it was their time to get up to speak, three of the five school committee just got up and left. And the two remaining one was snickering and talking to each other, one paying attention to these parents. And they got up and they looked at me and said, what should we do? Should we continue? I said, I don't know. I'm a young first year teacher. I don't even have a job. But I felt like I have to put up a strong front and give them strength. I said, I think it's recorded. Just go ahead and read your statement and we'll be recorded. Hopefully somebody would hear it. So they did that and we left again. We didn't hear anything. So the week before the last week of August, they got letters to say where school the kids are going to go to. And the school sent a bus to pick up the parent to show them what school the kids are going to be. So I went with one group to the school that most of the immigrant children would be going to. And when we got there, the bus was surrounded by adults from the neighborhood with placards that said, go home. We don't want you here. You don't belong here. Parents couldn't read those signs, but they can feel the animosity. They can feel the hostility and that tense atmosphere. And they look at me and said, is this where our kids are going to go to school? I said, yes, this is the school. So they went inside, walked through homes like this gauntlet of people, big signs around them. And they were really in awe of the school building. It was a brand new school, was built 2 years. It was opened in 1972, and this is the summer of 1975. And the school that their kids are coming from in Chinatown, it was the oldest continuous use red brick schoolhouse that's been used since the 1860s. So there's no comparison. Brand new school with air conditioning, books everywhere, nice equipment, shiny floors, working bathroom, things that their kids don't have. But that's not their concern. It's still be nice to have a school like that, but do our kids have to go through this every day when they come to school? So I guess that have a big impact on them. And when I got back, so that weekend before school start, and I just got back from my honeymoon, I got married, it's busy summer. I got a call from one of the parents and she said, Miss Lee, we're not sending our kids to school. I said, what does that mean? He said, all of us, we're not sending them to school until they can guarantee their safety. I said, well, how this is going to happen? How are you going to notify everybody? He said, we'll find a way. So this was like 2 nights before school start. And by that time, I just got my notice that I was to report to that school that I took them to during the summer. The very school that we were not welcomed by the neighborhood folks. Obviously, I said, okay, this is what's going to happen. I didn't even have time to think or feel. All I know is, these poor kids, they're going to be walked into a situation. So I volunteer with the principal to ride the bus with the students coming from where I live through Chinatown and then to Charlestown. It's about 20 minutes to half an hour from where we live. And that first day, it was a life-changing experience for me. The bus picked up two Black kids from the neighborhood. And then as they rode toward Chinatown, in each stop, there were a lot of people, but nobody got on the bus. So by the time we got to the meeting point before we entered Charlestown, which is on the end of a part of Boston, it's a part of Boston that is a community that's pretty isolated from the rest of the city because there's a bridge linking to it. So that's the part of town that see themselves as pretty separated from the rest of the city. So they don't welcome any newcomers anyway, let alone this is the first time large number of people of color be entering that part of the city. So we waited at the bridge. There were like 7 or 8 buses waited there for police to escort us into town. On the way in, just me and two Black students on the bus. On the way in, there were a lot of people on the street holding signs, but nobody threw stone or rock or bricks at the buses. So by the time we got into our assigned school and got off the bus, we got in it safely because there were a lot of police presence. But the principal was also waiting for me at the front door and said, I need you to hurry up to get in here. There's a phone call waiting for you. I said, I haven't even started school yet. Am I in trouble already? It was the phone call from the Justice Department and wanted me to organize a meeting with the Chinese Parents Association immediately. Well, we didn't have cell phone in those days. I said, wait a minute, you need to wait until I get home. And when people get home from work, I call them. So it took us 2 days to organize a meeting for the Justice Department to meet with the parents. And that happened on the third morning. And as soon as we walk in the door, the representative from the Justice Department told me, explain to these parents right away that what they're doing is illegal. I said, what is it that they're doing is illegal? I need to make clear before I translate. They said, boycotting school is illegal. So when I translated that, and one parent said, immediately turned to her and said, why is not illegal for white people? I was smiling inside. I said, oh, good for her. So she knows what's going on. And that set the tone for the rest of the meeting. Within half an hour, they got every demands that they put in that letter to send to the school committee where nobody pay attention, including the judge that oversee the whole busing case. I said, why is this so hard? And then I thank her as we were leaving the meeting. I said, you know, I'm glad that we resolved this issue and that I'm glad that somebody is concerned about our children's education. And she said to me, blank face, said, we really need the Chinese students back in school. The boycott was 99% successful. We need them back to be buffered. I said, buffer for what? Between the black and white student in case fights break out. My heart dropped. I said, is this what we're worth, to be buffer? But the parents, I couldn't even translate that for them and explain to them what that means, because they were so happy that they have won. And it was a long journey. No one in the community, including all the so-called community leaders in the Chinese community, were willing to help because they felt like it's an unwinnable situation. And in fact, some of the men and this community leader laughed at those parents and said, you guys are lowly, non-English speaking garment workers, women that don't know what's going on. You think you can go up against the government? So they think of like school committee as the government. But these mothers, when they heard their comments about what they're about to do, were incensed. They said, okay, if we don't get any help, we're just going to do it ourselves. And that's what they did. That win sets the tone for how we conduct struggles and win our rights within the Boston Chinese community for the next 50 years till now. That immigrant, non-English speaking women, when they get together, that strength and that steel behind them can do anything. And it completely changed the dynamic with our community. So that was a great lesson for me. That when people come together and stand their ground, we can do great things.
Part of the reason why I really wanted to do this interview with you, Suzanne, is precisely because of what you just said. Because I think it's so important for people to realize that they're not helpless as long as they dig into that sense that this is worth fighting for and we can do it if we do it together. One of the things mm-hmm. that really moved me was the acceptance speech you gave at UMass, and I'm just going to read it here. You never met a student you couldn't reach or a parent that didn't want the best for their children. And I think that's very different from what we hear in the media right now, that, you know, kids are out of control and their parents are out of control. But you see things very differently from your experience, and you are there at ground zero in a certain sense, that you actually see these people. Do you have any advice for how we can change the dialogue, change the discussion? Because I think a lot of what you've shared is that you had what basically amounts to a very traumatic childhood, but you turned that into something very positive.
I don't think it was deliberate. The way I look at it, things just happened. And this reminded me of a discussion that I had recently with a group of educators training to be school leaders, you know, like principals and superintendents. And it was their leadership class. And they invited me to speak to them and share my experience in education with them. And this question came up. They said, well, Boston busing years is famous in education world, how the traumatic experience and the chaotic thing. And it seems like when I gone through experience like that and continue to be a successful educator for 35 years in Boston Public School. And their question was, it must require some very strong mental toughness to have gone through that. I said, well, I never thought of that way, because my whole life, my life story, give me the experience and strength to tackle anything. That we don't have time to complain. You see an issue in front of you. Well, instead of wasting negative energy to complain about it, do something. But you need to do it together with other people, because by yourself, one person, yes, can spark and inspire, but you still need a whole lot of people coming together. That to me is what government for the people, by the people means, that we all have a role to play, whether or not you are elected in a certain position, whether or not you are the chosen leader, whether or not you are just a worker, we all have a role to play, because it would take all of us. But all of us need to understand that what we have in us and our responsibility in it to make democracy work. All this come back to democracy. Is that just the whole notion of democracy? Is it just a word? Or do we really want that to work? If we want that to work, then quality public education is at the core of that, to making it work. Because unless we have a educated citizenry, for them to be able to participate, have critical thinking skill, and really participate in the running of their life and in the government, then we are doomed. So it's in all of us to put in that energy instead of complaining. Come together and find solution. Because the elected officials are not any smarter than we are. Why do we leave it everything up to them? Why do we leave everything up to the principal or the superintendent? We all have a role to play, but it cannot be just your issue. It has to be issues and things that is for the common good. That's what we have to fight for. Because I'm not into putting energy into fighting for one person, but for those common good that all of us need to have to enjoy life, to have a full life. Things like quality public education, that everybody have a chance to be educated. Things like affordable housing, everybody deserves to have a roof over their head, a good job that can pay for that. That's not too much to ask. Why is it so hard? So it takes all of us to participate and get in there and dig in and participate in your local level as well as in your workplace. It's the same principle that I apply to running my school, my classroom, and the work that I do in the community. Listen to the people around you and organize them to understand the issue at hand, and ask people what they're willing to do. Through the discussion, you're going to find the solution to that challenging problem. And applying this principle have got me through life, have got me to a point where a whole lot of people ask me to share my experience with them.
Because you're an artist. You are an artist in this life, definitely. So,
well, I never look at it that way, but I guess. In fact, I enjoy painting, right? Never even have time to really pursue it in that way. But I was an art major before I turned into being an educator. So I
regard anybody that has a skill that they do well, and they also do it with the kind of passion and devotion that you have. Because as you said, you loved these moms that you were teaching English to. You know, when you do anything like that, with that kind of dedication and love, that's an art. That is a skill, and it requires creativity. You put 100% of yourself into that.
Well, yes, not only 100%, but I remember when I decided to take early retirement, because after 35 years, it was time. And I went into central office to say goodbye to all the secretaries and everybody that I know. And without fail, they would say to me, Miss Lee, you're so young. Why are you retiring? I said, you know, when I find that I cannot give my 150% anymore, that my health cannot sustain that, I have to step aside and let other people do it. And they looked at me and said, We'll take your 80% of anybody else's knife. What does that mean? He said, we know how much you put into it. I said, you know, teaching and in life in public education is about the children. And that's about our future. You have to put your all into it. Because if they don't get a good education, what kind of leaders are we going to get as a country? What goes around comes around. So we all have to put everything that we have to make sure that our children are taken care of. And there's no better place to do that to have quality public education. And that is a fight need doing, regardless of the background of the children, regardless of skin color, regardless their income level, where they came from, what kind of family. All children need the same thing. Love and support and find their niche and allow them to find joy in school. Then we have a better society and it's for our common good. So yeah, my health is a lot better since I retire and just work on those issues that I still put a lot into it. But it's not the same as having responsibility for the 800 students in my school.
Well,
so
I thank you for agreeing to do this. And I'm sure you have lots of faculty and staff members and a lot of students that would also really thank you for everything that you've done. And
yes,
I'm so glad. Yes. And I'm so glad you agreed to do this.
But I enjoyed this talk. I hope that, you know, other people would enjoy it too.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Mission Artist. If you'd like to learn more about Suzanne Lee, see more interviews and her UMass address, you can log onto our website, missionartist.org. Please join us for our next episode, where our guest will be studio composer, conductor, and musician Greg Smith. He'll be sharing his story about how he found himself writing a series of orchestral compositions for young persons or family-style concerts.